Okay, so this is all kind of practice for what's going to be on the exam. Start out with a few credits and work our way up. So for the first question, which I think of as being the easier question, we're supposed to figure out what's the altitude of the star when it culminates. And you pretty much want to be drawing this picture to show you that bit of information. So we draw the meridian. That's the line in the sky that goes from north, the north celestial pole, through zenith and back through south. So here I am standing under zenith, and the north celestial pole is pretty high in the sky because its altitude above the north point on the horizon is equal to the latitude. And the celestial equator goes the other way, from east to west, so it has to cross the meridian at some point. And what is the case is the celestial equator misses zenith by your latitude. Declination is the angle north or south of the celestial equator. So this star, Rigel, is 8 degrees this away, 8 degrees towards the south celestial pole. So from this picture, the angle we want to calculate is the angle the star is above the horizon. And there are lots of ways of doing it. What I kind of see immediately is that this total angle is obviously 50 plus 8. And it's a right angle. So this angle here has to be 90 minus 58 degrees, or 32 degrees. Okay. So for time of day, the starting point is that at noon, the sun is on the meridian. And if we can figure out the right ascension of the sun, then we can just work our way forward or backward from that location. And what we know is that on December 21, the right ascension of the sun is 18 hours, and it's got to go through 24 hours of right ascension in 12 months. So it's moving 2 hours per month. So the location of the sun on January 21 is going to be 20 hours of right ascension. And we need to work our way forward until we get to 5 hours, 10 minutes. So I kind of recommend making this little chart of the time versus the right ascension that's on the meridian. And if we start with noon, we know the right ascension that's on the meridian. It's the right ascension of the sun, 20 hours. And so at 1 p.m., 21 hours is going to be on the meridian. At 2 p.m., 22 hours is going to be on the meridian. At 3 p.m., 23 hours. At 4 p.m., 24 hours, which is the same thing as zero. And so 5 is going to be 1, 6 is going to be 2, 7 is going to be 3, 8 is going to be 4, 9 is going to be 5. We're getting close. 10 is too far. So we want to get 5, 10 on the meridian, and that's going to happen at 9, 10 p.m. Yes, yep. So long ago I said that you should memorize this chart. Now, for these quizzes, I'll always pick 21 days just so it's convenient. But I hope it's clear that if I ask some other sort of date, you could figure out what fraction it is of a month and what fraction you'd move forward. But I won't ask that question anyway, so it doesn't matter if you can do it or not. Questions? So we talked a bit about the globe and how the changing location of the sun affects the weather on those situations. And we delineated lots of kind of standard circles on the globe. So if we are within the Arctic Circle, if we're close to the North Pole, we will have a day that is 24 hours long. The sun won't set during that day. And sometime during the winter, we'll have a day that is at least 24 hours of darkness. And typically, we'll have more than that. So for example, at the North Pole itself, where the celestial equator is at the horizon, all of this time, 6 months of the year, we'll have the sun above the horizon. So over 3 months, it'll very slowly spiral its way up to 23 and a half degrees, and then the following 3 months, it'll spiral its way down 23 and a half degrees. And finally, after September 21, the sun will set, and we'll have then continual darkness for 6 months. Okay, but at least on some day, anywhere inside the Arctic Circle, we'll have a day that's 24 hours long and a night that's 24 hours long. In the tropics, between latitude plus 23 and a half degrees and minus 23 and a half degrees, the sun will be directly overhead sometime twice per year. So on the equator, where the celestial equator goes right through zenith, right, because latitude zero means the celestial equator is going to go through zenith, that'll happen on the equinoxes, March 21 and September 21. And of course, it works the same way for the Antarctic Circle, which is close to the South Celestial Pole. So the cause of the seasons is not the changing distance between the Earth and the Sun. That distance does change by millions of miles, but it's small change compared to the roughly 100 million miles that our average distance is from the Sun. So it's not due to the changing distance. And in fact, in the winter hemisphere, we're actually closest to the Sun during our winter. So what matters is kind of the time on task. How long is the sun above the horizon heating the surface of the earth? And how direct is that light? That is to say, if you shine light directly on a surface, it has more effect, heating effect, than if you aim it at a slanting angle. So the sun is higher in the sky during the summer, and it's up for more than 12 hours. And those two things combine to give us lots of heating of the ground. And of course, vice versa during the winter. We talked about the analemma, which is often pasted to the side of a globe. The analemma is the location of the sun on the sky throughout the year at a particular time. And of course, sometimes the sun is north of the celestial equator, sometimes it's south of the celestial equator. What's a little bit surprising is that the sun isn't a regular timekeeper. Sometimes the sun is a little bit ahead of its kind of average location, and sometimes it's behind in its average location. And that's for two reasons. One reason is that, in fact, the sun isn't going around the celestial sphere at an even rate. It's taking a little bit bigger steps per day when it's close to the Earth, right, this January 4th, 5th time period, and it's taking smaller steps in the summer. So it's not actually moving at a constant rate, and that's one thing that'll cause this effect. The other effect is the tilted path of the ecliptic. So even if the sun had a constant step size, if it was going the same distance every day on the celestial sphere, kind of automatically at an equinox, when it's not going so much east-west, it'll have a smaller effect. On the other hand, when it is near these peaks or valleys, the same size step will go through a larger range of right ascension. So we have this kind of two per year times when the sun is moving unusually fast, and two times per year when the sun is moving unusually slow. And that's what gives us the two bulges that makes the eight of the analemma. So the amount of kind of the mismatch of the sun's location to its average location is about plus minus 15 minutes. So sundials can't actually keep super accurate time. And it's well known to the Greeks, who actually occasionally inscribed the analemma on the sundial so that they could make that correction. Questions? Okay, so we're on to chapter 3, which deals with the moon. So we have on our SCO-01 the path of the sun on the sky. We don't have the path of the planets, and we don't have the path of the moon. And that's because all of those paths are a little bit irregular. The ecliptic is very, very constant over millions of years, not so the other sorts of paths. But roughly speaking, we've said that the path of the planets and the moon are close to the ecliptic. So in fact, the path of the moon typically misses the ecliptic by about 5 degrees. So sometimes it's above the ecliptic by 5 degrees, sometimes it's below the ecliptic by 5 degrees. It has to pass between those two, so twice a year it's right on the ecliptic. So if we kind of take a look at what that means for the location of the sun, the sun should be someplace around there right now, right? We're just a little bit past the winter solstice. And let's kind of follow through a period of the moon's orbit. So we start with the moon being in the same direction as the sun. It's probably not going to be right on top of the sun because it's usually going to miss by about 5 degrees, but it might be right on top of the sun. More on that in a second. As it goes on, the moon is going to be moving and the sun is going to be moving substantially slower. So the moon is eventually going to widen its angle from the sun and then catch up about a month later. So there are actually two periods that are of interest in this process. The first period is how long it takes from being in the same direction of the sun until it's caught up to that moving target again. That's called the synoptic period. So that's from the moon being in the direction of the sun to it again being in the same direction as the sun. And that's roughly speaking 30 days. If you want to be a little bit more accurate, it's about 29 and a half days. So roughly speaking, a month. In fact, it's pretty much what's defining our month. But probably of greater significance is the time it actually takes to go around the celestial sphere. So if the moon started here, how long did it take to get back to there? That's called the sidereal period. Sidereal means relative to the stars. And that's obviously a little bit less because we're not catching up to that moving target. Yeah, it's about 27 and a third days. In any case, it's a little bit shorter than the other period. So if we start out in this sort of situation, we're obviously not going to be able to see the moon because it's in the direction as the same direction as the sun, and the sun is way brighter than the moon. But 1 or 2 days later, the moon will be separated enough from the sun that we can see it. And the most convenient time to see that sun is going to be at sunset. Because under those circumstances, remember you can take your SCO-01, aim the north part of it towards the north celestial pole, and line up the equator, celestial equator, with how the equator will look in the west. So if I do that, here's the west point, here's the celestial equator. You can see that under the circumstance, the sun is going to be setting in the west, and this moon is going to be a little bit over on that side. Now, the moon is being illuminated by the sun, so the white part of the moon will be, first of all, pretty small because mostly the moon will be in darkness, and it'll also be pointed in the direction of the sun, like a bow and arrow. So you can think about this thing is being a bow. If you shoot an arrow from the moon, it's supposed to hit the sun. Okay. The next day, of course, the moon is going to have moved a little bit further from the sun, so there'll be a little bit more white, but the white should still be aiming pretty much at the sun. So we have names for these things. This thing is called a crescent moon. And the white is growing. There's more and more white every day. And kind of the old-fashioned word for growing is waxing. So this is a waxing crescent moon. Now you can see, if you look carefully, there's no reason you can't see that moon during the day. It'll be hard to distinguish from a cloud. It won't be particularly bright, but you know, if we just rotate this picture up 6 hours earlier, that same moon was above the horizon. But it's a whole lot easier to see when the sun is a lot dimmer. And of course, very easy to see when the sun is actually down. So if we continue this process day by day by day by day by day, the moon is getting further and further from the sun, right? So it started out like that at sunset, but a week later it's going to be about 90 degrees from the sun. So the sun is going to be setting there in the west, and if we turn 90 degrees to the south, this moon will be culminating on the meridian with, of course, its white part pointing towards the sun. So this is a moon that is half black and half white. So this is a, oddly enough, a first quarter. Why quarter if it's a half moon? Well, because we're a quarter of the way through the cycle. So if we go the next day, I don't know if this thing will stick the next day. I'll move it all the way over here. That won't stick. If I go to a larger angle than 90 degrees between the sun and the moon, then the moon will now be in the eastern half of the sky, not very far from south, but a little bit east of south. And there will now be more than 50% of the moon illuminated. So it no longer looks like a crescent, so we need a new name for this. This is a gibbous moon. And day to day to day, there's going to be more and more white on this gibbous moon. So this is a waxing gibbous moon. Now, as more and more of the moon gets illuminated, it's easier and easier to see it in the daytime. But of course, it's going to have risen not that long ago. So you're not going to see that waxing gibbous moon at noon, for example. It would be before it had risen, right? Because there has to be more than 90 degrees between the sun and that moon. So if we continue this process as long as we can reach a situation where there is 180 degrees between the sun and the moon. How can I do that? Well, it's actually about 180 degrees the way it was. Maybe this will be a better moon. Yes. So under these circumstances, the moon will be rising as the sun sets in the west. So here, all the way in the east, we have a moon rising. And if you think about what has to be happening, the face that we're seeing on the moon will be fully illuminated by the sun. So this moon will be 100% white. So this is a full moon. The next day, the angle between the moon and the sun will be more than 100 degrees, so this moon will not be above the horizon when the sun sets. But if you wait an hour or so, it will be above the horizon. It won't have quite as much white on it anymore, but it won't be a crescent. It'll be a gibbous moon, but from day to day to day now, that gibbous moon is going to be less and less white. So under these circumstances, we have a waning gibbous moon. So that waning gibbous moon will be visible most of the night, but a good time to look at it is actually at sunrise. So if we think about the situation at sunrise, so here we are in the east and the sun is rising, and this gibbous moon will be way over here in the west, above the horizon, with the white part pointing towards the very distant sun. If we wait another week or so, we'll have that moon be 90 degrees from the sun, with the white part pointing towards the sun. And as the days go on, we're going to have a thin crescent moon that will eventually disappear into the glare of the sun. So this is going to be a waning crescent phase. Now you can see that waning crescent phase during the day, of course. At noon, that moon will be a little bit to the right of the sun. But at sunset, that moon will have set already beforehand. So the first lab project is, of course, to follow these phases of the moon and to draw pictures that show what the moon looks like and to figure out what constellation the moon is, all that sort of good stuff. Questions? Let's take a look at some pictures of moon phases. I wonder if I'm going to be unhappy about the curtains being open. We'll see. Maybe while I wait for that thing to warm up, I'll get it a little bit darker. Why don't you get that one over there? Okay. So this is a picture taken at a little bit after sunset. I hope you know from kind of the directions of on campus, we're looking kind of southwest. And here we have a crescent moon, and we have, turns out, Saturn and Venus that are more or less along the ecliptic, right? The ecliptic has to lie kind of like this. So the sun must have set over there a few hours ago. Okay, so this picture was actually taken, looks like there are leaves on the trees, but I think it was taken in winter. Here's another picture, pretty similar situation. This is now Venus by itself. This is years apart. And notice that this moon is higher in the sky. And that's just a seasonal effect, right? This picture was taken during the summer. This one was taken during the winter. But in both cases, it's white on the right. And this is a waxing phase. So here's a picture taken of the observatory. Maybe this is a little bit bigger of a crescent moon. We're looking again kind of southwestish, and it's white on the right for this waxing phase. I don't know if you can see it, but can you see the similar phased moon sitting in the blue sky? So where the sun has to be is up here someplace. So this is a picture that was taken maybe 1 p.m. or something like that. And we're looking kind of southeastish in the blue sky to pick out this, again, white on the right, and hence waxing crescent moon. Here's another moon. It's kind of hard to pick out. Same story. And so the sun has to be kind of up that way to be illuminating this white on the right moon. Okay, so here's a moon that is, this is, I hope, again, if you recognize directions, the front face of Peter Engel is being illuminated from the sun, so this has to be in the afternoon. And we have this moon that is rising in the east. And if you can look, this is, I would say, a little bit past half moon. So this is a waxing gibbous phase moon that is visible in the daylight. It would be even more prominent, of course, if we waited a few hours for the sun to set. So this, again, if you recognize your directions, there are a couple of things that should be clear, that this is a evening, and this is evening in the summer, because it's only in the summer that the front face of the bell banner gets illuminated, because the sun has to be north of the celestial equator in order for that to occur. And you can see here a moon that is almost full that rose not too long ago in the east as this sun was setting. So again, if you know your directions on campus, you know that now we're looking west over at the dorms. And this is a morning shot. You can see because these things are just starting to get illuminated. And this is obviously a full moon that is just rising in the morning, 180 degrees from where the sun is setting, or excuse me, rising in the east. So here's a picture of a moon that is maybe a little bit past half third quarter phase, where we have a half moon. And again, it's white on the left now, indicating that this is a waning phase. Morning shot again. Pretty similar situation. We're looking south now, and we have this more or less half moon in the morning that is white on the left. And here's a morning shot where we have a waning crescent phase moon, more or less in the east in the view of the rising sun. So those were all taken at St. John's. This was not taken at St. John's. This was taken in California. What is that? So it's white. It's, you know, right or left is maybe a hard thing to determine, but it's white on the right, I would say. So it's waxing, and it's clearly a little bit more than half done. So this is waxing gibbous phase. It was taken in the evening. You can see that the front surface of this palm tree is being illuminated, so the sun must be behind behind my back, my photographer's back. Okay, so the upshot of all of this is one of your homework assignment is to do a series of quizzes yourself. So if you go to the usual class website, you'll see down here, moon quiz. Oh, name these moon quiz. That's what we're doing first. This is very similar. In fact, some of the identically same pictures where I want you to recognize what's going on. So all these pictures were either taken in California or here at St. John's. I wouldn't say anything until you take your quiz. Since we've got everything up, let's spend a second to take a look at the things that we talked about last time. So, you know that we've got this solar farm out there, roughly speaking, and you know that it's hot in the summer and cold in the winter. You can get the data for that solar farm online if you want. And you can record the number of watts per square meter that are being collected by that solar farm at any given time. And you can see here that hugely more amount of light is being collected in the summer than in the winter. And you can see the reasons why the sun is above the horizon more in the summer than it is in the winter. And the sunlight is more direct in the summer than in the winter, so we get more power, right? So it's not a small effect. You can see there are 3-4 times more energy that's heating us in the summer than it is in the winter, all due to these angle sort of effects. I don't know what this picture of. Oh, this is a picture, kind of a combination of pictures that show the phenomena of a 24-hour day, not at the North Pole, but near the Arctic Circle, so that the sun is coming close to the horizon here in the north. Here, of course, it's culminating in the south, and we've put together the circle of the sun going around under these circumstances. So here's our standard analemma. This time we have dates and times marked on the location. And you can read off here the amount of time that the sun is ahead of its position and when it's behind its position. If we look at the graph of that thing, we can have pretty much the same effect. So sometimes the sun is a little bit ahead of its average position, sometimes it's behind its average position. Here are our standard locations, much more nicely drawn than I could do on the board for these standard circles. And you know that the Earth is spinning, so at any given time, the zenith of different people around the Earth is pointing in different directions. So while it may be noon to somebody, it won't be noon to people who are to the east or to the west. So we divide up the globe into 24 time zones in order to have roughly the same amount of time in all of these locations. So these things are about 15 degrees wide, because 15 degrees times 24 zones gives you 360 degrees. Okay, questions on any of that sort of stuff? Well, let's get back to this situation that we started talking about, the moon and the sun in pretty much the same direction. I guess I didn't give a name for that. That's called the new moon. Now, we said that usually the moon is going to miss the ecliptic by about 5 degrees, but they're both great circles, and great circles have to intersect at two locations. So if we are at one of those special spots where the orbit, as it were, of the moon and the orbit of the sun are at the same location, and they're both at that location, then we can have one object move right in front of the other object. Or we can have 180 degrees away, we can have the moon move into the shadow of the sun. So these are situations where something is going to go dark. In a solar eclipse, the moon covers up the sun, so the sun goes dark. In a lunar eclipse, the moon moves into the shadow of the Earth, and the moon goes dark. And they have kind of radically different experiences. So here we have kind of a fancy picture. The sun is someplace way off to the top, and here we have the shadow of the Earth. Now, first of all, there are names for these types of shadow. This is the full shadow of the Earth, the umbra, and this is the partial shadow of the Earth, the penumbra. And to kind of give you a feeling of what I mean by those terms, here we go. So here's kind of a similar picture. If you're in the penumbral shadow, a point like D, what you would see is a sun that is partially eclipsed. So you'd still be in sunlight, because part of you would be seeing the edge of the sun. Whereas if you were someplace like here, you would see the sun totally covered up by the moon. Right? So cases like D and A correspond, where is A? Oh, so A is in the full shadow, excuse me. So that has the sun fully obscured. But if you are in this penumbra area, what you're going to see is a sun that is partially covered up. But you're still going to be in the sunlight, because some of the sun is exposed. Well, maybe it's worth talking about situation C too. So in situation C, we can always see some of the edge of the sun, and in fact, we can see 360 degrees around the edge of the sun. So under these circumstances, we would see a full circle of illuminated sunlight. And this is called an annular eclipse. And clearly the important situation is whether we are too far from the moon or close enough to the moon in order to have this phenomena occur. And it turns out that just as the distance between the Earth and the sun varies a little bit, the distance between the Earth and the moon varies a little bit. So about half of our solar eclipses are like this, where the sun at best is not fully covered. And the other half of our solar eclipses are situations like this, where we have a fully illuminated sun. Okay, so with that in mind, let's kind of go to this situation. So here we have the sun someplace up to the top. Here, incidentally, these are not at all to scale. The moon is way far further away compared to this picture. And here we have the shadow of the moon. What is more or less accurately displayed here is that the dot of the moon that is in full shadow is small. Typically less than 1,000 miles in diameter, maybe only a few hundred miles in diameter. So the places that will experience an eclipse of the sun are going to lie along some line that is relatively small. And so most people on Earth will never experience a solar eclipse unless they go visit the spot where the sun will be exactly covered up. Lots of people will experience partial eclipse of the sun, but only a few people will experience the full solar eclipse. Doesn't work that way for the lunar eclipse. For the lunar eclipse, everyone in the dark hemisphere of the Earth will see the moon go from being partially illuminated to being fully dark. So it's much easier to see a lunar eclipse than it is to see a solar eclipse. The other thing has to do with the timing. So again, this diagram is pretty accurate in terms of scale. It takes hours for the moon to move into darkness, to move through darkness, and to come out the other side. So lunar eclipses go over a period of time of hours, whereas solar eclipses, as the shadow of the moon rips across the surface of the Earth, and of course the Earth is spinning too, so it's typically this intersection point is moving thousands of miles an hour. So a longish solar eclipse would be on the order of 10 minutes. So huge differences in who can experience it and how long the experience is going to take. So again, the only time we're actually going to have an eclipse is when we happen to be at one of these spots where the orbit of the moon intersects the orbit of the sun. And you might think at first glance that that should happen at the same time every year, right? Because the only time it can happen is when the sun is at that spot, and the sun is at that spot on a particular day of the year. But if we look at the actual data, see that that's not the case. So this is a plot where we have the months of the year, January, February, March, etc. And we also have little marks that show where we have solar eclipses and lunar eclipses, and anywhere on the globe. And notice that the solar and lunar eclipses are happening earlier and earlier in the year as we go through time. So the intersection point between the orbit of the moon and the orbit of the sun is changing. This is called precession. And it's changing on about an 18-year cycle. Right, you can see, roughly speaking, these eclipses are a little bit less than a month earlier per year. And if you work it all out, it's about 18 years to go through a full cycle. So kind of the picture you should have is kind of like this. We have, so this is the orbit of the Earth and the Sun, and the Moon's orbit is inclined. So the only time things can line up is when the plane of the Moon's orbit intersects the plane of the Sun's, of the Earth's orbit, and the Sun is along that same line, right? So under these circumstances, if the Moon is here, the shadow of the Moon is going to miss the Earth, and if the Moon is at this position, the Moon is going to miss the shadow of the Earth. So we won't have a lunar eclipse and we won't have a solar eclipse. Only under these circumstances will we have an actual eclipse. I guess this is a better thing to point at. Notice that if we had a solar eclipse, we're pretty much due to a lunar eclipse, right? Lunar and solar eclipses tend to happen pretty close together in time. And that's because the sun doesn't move very fast. So if it's in a node for this first eclipse, it's going to be very close to a node for the second possible eclipse. So this was a case where we had a new moon and a solar eclipse, and then a full moon and a lunar eclipse just 2 weeks apart. Okay, so pretty common to have eclipses. And if you just look at kind of the typical number, if you pick any given year, roughly speaking, 4 eclipses per year, 2 solar and 2 lunar. But there can be more than that if we have very special situations. I'm not sure there are any real special situations that are depicted here. Looks like pretty much every year there, well, I guess if you count that as a year, right? Where we're getting some in January and some in December because the whole thing has moved up. But it's actually possible to have 2 lunar eclipses and a solar eclipse all close enough together if things are just perfect. Okay. Let's go back and think about this process another way. I want something for my moon back. So if this is the sun and that's the moon, are we likely to see the moon at sunrise or sunset? I don't like that answer. I like the other answer better. Sunset. So a couple of ways to think about it. I guess the way I want to stress more is you can think about taking this map and lining it up with the sky, right? So aim the north part of the sky at the north celestial pole and put it in the west, line up the celestial equator here, and you can see that the sun is going to be below and to the right of that moon, and so the moon will be visible. On the other hand, when that sun was rising, that moon would be below the horizon. So another way of getting it right, and I'm not super happy about this way, but it works too, is remember that the moon is moving this way, right? So, and the order of phases is to get things that are visible in the evening, and then eventually to get things that are visible at sunset as the moon catches up. So the kind of important lesson here is these are the stars that are going to be particularly prominent at sunset, and these are the stars that are going to be visible when the sun is rising. So we've been talking about the moon. How about the rest of the noticeable planets? So probably the brightest planet, and one that is visible now, is Venus. So we know that Venus has an orbit that is inside the orbit of the Earth, and for that reason it's called an inferior planet. Okay, and all that means, Mercury would be the other example of an inferior planet. So if this is the orbit of the Earth, here's the Sun. Any planet that has an orbit that's interior to that is an inferior planet. Now let's think about what that means. So for any inferior planet, as viewed from the Earth, it can't get very far from the Sun. It could be a little bit on the right of the Sun, it could be a little bit on the left of the Sun, but it can't be, for example, 180 degrees from the Sun. It's always going to be pretty close. So we can talk about what's called the maximum angle of elongation. So that's the biggest angle that planet can be from the sun. And in round numbers, for Venus, it's around 45 degrees. And for Mercury, it's about 30 degrees. So how does the motion of Venus occur? Well, so if we start with Venus and the Sun in the same direction, which is called conjunction, Venus can move to being on the other side of the Sun, and then it can fall back and be on the other side of the Sun, and then it can come back and be on the other side of the Sun. It's going back and forth in front of the sun, right? And that's exactly what you would see happening as viewed from Earth in this sort of picture. So what that means is Venus is going to alternate being visible in the evening sky with being visible in the morning sky. So we talk about evening stars and morning stars. Of course, it's not a star at all. But it actually took a while for civilization to figure out that this bright dot that was visible in the morning and then disappeared and then we saw something in the evening was actually the same object, that it was Venus. So here's kind of the picture that you would see. So here we're looking west at sunset, sun just below the horizon. Venus could be a little bit above the ecliptic, a little bit below the ecliptic, but it always has to be pretty close to the sun. So currently, I think Venus is reaching pretty close to its maximum angle of elongation, and it's going to soon disappear into the glare of the sun. Not by the end of the semester, but certainly by the end of the year. Mercury moves a lot faster, and it never gets as far from the sun. So my bet is that you've never seen Mercury. You really have to be very intentional if you want to see Mercury. Going pretty soon after sunset and then looking pretty carefully for a star that isn't all that bright in that particular location. And of course, it works the reverse at sunrise looking east, right? The celestial equator is going to be angled kind of like that. So Venus can be far from the sun, it can be close from the sun. And it's going to alternate between this evening star and morning star status. How about the rest of the planets? So the rest of the planets are called superior planets. So Mars is a good example. We can see Mars now in Jupiter. So let's be specific about this. So you might remember you had this chart of the right ascension declinations of these various planets. So here we have Mars as having a right ascension that is 11 hours, 38 minutes, and a declination of plus 6 degrees. So Mars is about there. And currently, this is where the sun was on December 21, so 2 hours per month, the sun should be about there. So this is a Mars that is almost 180 degrees from the sun. So what's going to be the phenomena for Mars? Well, it turns out that the superior planets, all of the planets, generally speaking, and the moon, are going the same way the sun is going. But the superior planets are moving slower than the sun. The moon is obviously moving faster than the sun. So the future of Mars is that it's going to move a little bit, but the sun is going to move more. So the angle between the sun and Mars is going to get smaller and smaller and smaller. So in the future, it's not going to happen this fast, but in the future, the sun is going to catch up to Mars, and we're going to see it as an evening star, and then it's going to disappear into the glare of the sun, and we can see it again as a morning star, and we can repeat the cycle again. So it depends on the planets. So the planets, the further out you go, mostly when I'm talking about planets in this context, I'm thinking about planets you can see with your naked eye, which would be from Saturn to Mercury. If you remember the back of your Starfinder chart, I think I had you look at this, for Saturn, it doesn't move very much. It's pretty much in the same constellation. So it takes it a long time to go around in its orbit. So for Saturn, it'll go from being in conjunction with the sun to being in conjunction in the sun again pretty much in a year. Mercury moves a little bit faster, and it's from conjunction to conjunction is more like 2 years. Okay? So we've got a word for when Mars is in the same direction as the sun. It's nice to have a word for when it's 180 degrees from the sun, the same thing as a full moon. That's called opposition. So again, an inferior planet can never be in opposition to the sun. It always has to be close to the sun. The superior planets can be in opposition to the sun. And those are times usually when they are particularly bright. Now let's take a look at that for the case of Mars. So if here is the sun, and here is the orbit of the Earth, and here's the orbit of Mars just a little bit further out. So if Mars is in opposition to the sun, then it's there, right? 180 degrees from the sun. So under these circumstances, the distance between Mars and the Earth is unusually small. Whereas if Mars is in conjunction with the sun, or nearly in conjunction in the sun, then Mars is a greater distance away, and so it's going to look a lot dimmer. And the effect for Mars is huge. Yeah, of course, as you go further and further out, you know, whether you add the distance to the Earth is from the Sun for Jupiter or not doesn't make a big difference. So for the other superior planets, there isn't this huge change in brightness. But always, the superior planets will be brightest in opposition. Okay, questions? So the actual motion of the superior planets is a little bit more complicated than what I've described. So for the Sun, we have pretty simple motion. The path of the Sun for millennia is going to be pretty much the same. It's the ecliptic, which is a nice great circle. It's not moving at exactly the same rate, because remember it's moving a little bit faster in January than it's moving in other years. But that's a pretty regular motion. For the motion of the Moon, it's always going in the same direction. Just like the Sun, sometimes it's going a little bit faster and a little bit slower, but it's not a particularly big effect. But remember that the path of the Moon is changing with time. The intersection points between the Moon's path and the Sun's path go through this 18-year cycle. But that's still pretty simple. The superior planets, it's kind of noticeably more complicated. So we actually have ancient documents. So this is data from small numbers AD. There it is, 133 AD, taken by this guy called Ptolemy. And you can see is that while Saturn, in this particular case, is generally moving in this direction, it does it in this two steps forward, one step backward sort of way. So while generally speaking, the superior planets are going in the same way, they're doing it in a really funny fashion. So they're going like this. These periods of time when this period here from there to there, this period of time when a planet is moving backwards, that's called retrograde motion. It's moving in the opposite of its normal sense. So let's hold off for a second and think about this. So if here's our SC001, remember that the whole celestial sphere is spinning, right? So the whole celestial sphere is going to be moving through the sky with things, generally speaking, setting in the west and rising in the east. So generally speaking, this whole celestial sphere is moving that way, one full rotation in a day. Meanwhile, the Sun is moving the other way, 1 degree per day. So on any given day, the Sun is pretty much in the same location, and it's going to be swept along with everything else on the celestial sphere in this rising and setting motion. And when we've just talked about a retrograde piece of a superior planet's motion, it's in the opposite direction that the Sun is moving on the celestial sphere, but that's in the same direction that the celestial sphere is rotating once every day. So lots of possibilities to get confused about. So retrograde means the opposite direction that the Sun's slow motion on the celestial sphere is, not the opposite of the daily rotation of the celestial sphere.
Is it because of gravitational pull that happens, or what's the nonsense?
I'm pretty much going to say no, although I could also answer yes if I wanted to. So,
what is causing the superior planets to do that awkward motion? This guy. Is it our position, or is it literally that the?
Well, you're.
Are actually doing that?
You're cheating. You're asking too good a question.
Well, I mean, you can look at it in different ways. That's why.
Well, we want to know the answer to your question, but you can see I have to dig down. I have to dig down in these transparencies to a couple of days ahead to give you an answer. So these days people don't ride trains very much anymore. But if you've ever ridden in a train, you've had the experience that you look across out of your window and you see another train that seems to be moving, and you're not sure whether it's that train that's moving or it's you that's moving, because trains start out really smoothly. So we see these planets moving. Another possibility is we're the one that's doing the moving, that's causing this effect. Not so much the motion of the other planets. And that's really what's going on. So we're going to come back to this, but to answer your question now, here we have the position of something like Mars, which is moving pretty slowly. And here we have the Earth, which is moving faster. And what happens when Mars seems to be moving backwards is the Earth is actually passing Mars by. So as we swish by, it looks like Mars has gone backwards, but it's not actually going backwards. So it took... So it took basically 2,000 years to figure that out. So it's not at all obvious that that's the case. But it is the case. So these retrograde motions, I don't know, now that I've let the cat out of the bag, you can see they're going to happen when the planet is in opposition. That's when we're going to have particularly strong retrograde motion. And I want to stress that this, well, let's take a look at the case of Saturn. So here's actual data for the case of Saturn. And you can see that the amount of this retrograde loop is from 255 to 148, right? So less than 20 degrees. And 20 degrees is about the size of a typical constellation. So this is not a matter that the planet is literally going to be seeming to move backwards in the sky. It's just a matter that instead of, if we have a constellation like Taurus, looks kind of like that, instead of the planet moving, you know, very small amounts per day like this, there'll be a period of time when it goes backwards and comes this way. So it's not something you're going to notice unless you really go out and plot out the locations of these things with reasonably good accuracy, which, as I say, you can see the Greeks did long, long ago. But it's not particularly noticeable without fairly careful work. Okay, so I think I'll call it quits there. So let me be clear about the assignment, since I didn't write them up top. You've got that "What Moon Is It?" quiz. So there's another quiz that's labeled Moon Quiz. The first one we're talking about, Name That Moon. And we're going on now to chapter 4 in the text. So I remind two-thirds of you that we've got lab on Wednesday. And we've got an exam a week from Friday. And what we'll do, and maybe next time or the time after that, is we'll schedule a time. You can always come by to my office to ask questions. And if you look, the solutions to the old exams are also exist as webcasts. But you know, it's nice to have an opportunity you can ask questions as a group. And so we'll schedule a time to do that based on a vote. Okay, so. Oh, and yeah, don't forget this talk by this astronaut. You can ask him whether I did as bad a job teaching now then as I did now.